Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, where we don't sugarcoat success, we dissect it. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and today's episode flips the script on traditional business advice. We're not talking about canned leadership tips or recycled sales hacks. Today, we're going to deep dive into the story of a guy who's trained sales teams in over 30 countries, got fired for doing the right thing, nearly deported mid-career, and still managed to turn that chaos into purpose, profit, and a pack of very grateful rescue dogs. Because here's the deal. Sometimes your next breakthrough isn't in another webinar. It's in a muddy dog pen in Northern California. So this one's about resilience, reinvention, and why empathy is your most underrated business weapon. So buckle up. My guest today is Ian Spandau, a man whose resume reads like a Silicon Valley power list until you hit the plot twist. After decades leading global sales training at companies like Oracle, MongoDB, and WalkMe, Ian walked away from the tech world. Let's be real. He was pushed out for standing up for someone who couldn't speak up for themselves. And instead of spiraling, he doubled down on something that actually mattered. Today, he's the founder of Spandau House Dog Rescue, a nonprofit sanctuary that's giving abused dogs a second chance and maybe giving corporate leadership a reality check while he's at it. Ian's new book, Rescuing Dogs and Salespeople, A Memoir from the Mutt, isn't your standard business memoir. It's sharp, it's raw, and unexpectedly heartwarming. He draws unforgettable parallels between building trust with a traumatized rescue dog and rehabilitating the underperforming, undervalued salespeople that corporate America often throws away. He's the plucky Irishman who went from training boardrooms to cleaning kennels and found more clarity, purpose, and leadership in the barn than he ever did in the C-suite. Today, we're talking about sales, second chances, and why getting dirty might be the cleanest path to real impact. So let me say welcome to the spotlight, Ian. I am so glad you're here. I can't wait to get through this.
Thank you, Kelly, for that wonderful introduction. It's always nice to speak to another Irish person over here in America.
Yes, we are family, it turns out. Those bonds dig deep and they're tight. You've lived quite a few lives. You were an Irish tech exec and an Oracle insider, a dog rescuer. But we got to rewind because I always love to go back to the journey. And what was the first moment that really cracked open the idea that your life and your work might need to go in a radically different direction?
Well, there have been several of them, honestly. The very first moment for me was when I was about 5 years old and a Kirby vacuum cleaner salespeople came to our home in Dublin. And they were American, and I'd never seen an American before. Well, not in real life. I'd seen them on television. And I thought these guys were so cool. And they sold my parents a vacuum cleaner and did the demo. And I followed them around and was just fascinated by them. And from that moment on, I always knew I want to go to America. I want to move to America. Now, it took me 40 years to get here because I was actually 40 when I finally got my green card. But that and my grandmother was a dog breeder, and she bred Rhodesian Ridgebacks. As a very small child, when we would visit her, this was in what was then Rhodesia, but now known as Zimbabwe, I was just taken, of course, by these impeccable dogs and how well they were trained, and there was always puppies to play with. So the two things happened for me at a very young age. From 5 or 6 years old, I was dogs and sales. I thought sales was cool.
It's awesome. And now, to date, you've trained like 9,000 sales pros in 30 countries. That's quite an accomplishment. But with all that exposure to people and systems, When did you start to realize that there were some broken things in this kind of traditional approach to leadership and success. What was the pivot point?
Yeah, so it was pretty easy because I ran my own company through the 90s in Ireland. I was CEO there of a software development firm, and it went very well. That Celtic Tiger, I'm sure you remember hearing about, a lot of American software companies moved into Ireland, and my company built training courses, so we had plenty of customers in the 90s. However, 9/11, and that all changed. We had a lot of customers on Wall Street and several in the Twin Towers. And after 9/11, we didn't even have an address to send our invoices to. So unfortunately, I think I was worth 3.5 million or something at 29, and I was worth 2 pennies at 30, because I sold the company for 1 penny to my largest customer. And at that point, that was the first big pivot. I did most things backwards, Kelly. Most people work for software companies and what have you, and then maybe later in life start their own firm. I started at 20 with my partner, and ran that company for just about 11 years. So after that, a bit of consulting, Oracle had been a customer of mine in the 90s and built training courses on their behalf. They wanted a sales coach, and I had run small businesses, and it was directed at small businesses. So I joined Oracle, I think it was 2004, first employer I'd ever had, first time I ever got a paycheck from anybody else, other than that didn't have my own signature on it. And honestly, it was such an eye-opener to me, such an eye-opener, because huge corporate life where I had run a 50-person startup, very different. And I really didn't understand the politics of big corporations like that, so I just put my head down and started working as hard as I could. And God bless them if they didn't keep promoting me. I never asked for a promotion, never applied for a promotion. But two promotions later, I was actually promoted out to Redwood Shores in California, which is where how I finally got to move to America in 2010. And I was one of those L1 visa people that can only work for the corporation that hired me. And if I didn't work for them, I had to get out of the country. So stop me if I'm boring you, but I got very fortunate. I was defending an Indian's rights because they were paying Indians a lot less than they were paying Caucasians. And back in Europe, that's illegal, and we were trained not to do it. So when I was asked to do it, I said no. And as a whistleblower, I was fired the next day. And I was told I had 7 days to leave the country, and they had contacted ICE and told them that my visa was expired and what have you. Now, my wife is from Texas, Amy, and I'm sure you know about Texans, but you don't mess with them. So she came home on that fateful day. It was just before Christmas, actually, just a week before Christmas. She said, "How was your day, love?" And I said, "I've had better ones." And she goes, "How?" And I said, "I got fired today and I have to leave the country in seven days." And she said, "Over my dead body." Now, there was a word in between dead and body, but we won't say that on your podcast.
I hear it. I bet you.
And we got married 5 weeks later at City Hall in San Francisco. That was 14 years ago now, and we've been happily married ever since. So that saved me. Now, I couldn't work here for 6 months because it takes a long time, even after you're married, to get your green card and what have you. So there were challenges around that time, for sure. But I ended up at one of Oracle's competitors, MongoDB, and took it from there, really. Took it from there. At that time, we started fostering dogs because MongoDB was the first company I'd worked for that allowed dogs in the office.
Ooh.
So as soon as I bought, I remember on my first day, I think it was walking in, there was two or three dogs lying around on people's desks. I'm like, "What? Wait, you can bring a dog to work?" And they're like, "Yeah, sure." So a week later, we went and fostered our first dog. Now, when I say fostered, he was also our first foster fail, because you know how that goes, right? It's like the puppy dog sale in sales. Once you have it for a week and you love them, you don't want to give them back.
Yes.
So we started volunteering for a San Francisco-based nonprofit, and we fostered many dogs over the years out of our little tiny apartment in San Francisco, which we weren't meant to have any animals in, by the way, but somehow we got away with it. So the pandemic, I'll jump forward to the pandemic, and we started our own rescue in 2020. The pandemic was that pivotal moment where we realized, hang on, I can work from home now full time. My wife works in a hospital, she's a nurse. So let's go and get some land in the country and start our own rescue. And there were several dogs that are just unadoptable. They're lovely dogs, but they can't be safely adopted to other people. And they never seem to be anywhere for those type of dogs. So we're a sanctuary slash rescue. We've We've rehomed a little over 200 dogs, and we have about seven here at the moment that are likely sanctuary dogs. Some of them were adopted twice and returned to us. A lot of times dogs just bond with their rescuer, and then they won't easily bond with anyone else. Particularly dogs that we pull out of the shelters that are on euthanasia lists or something like that. They seem to almost know, or they just seem to be so grateful to you for taking them out of that horrible environment that, yeah, they're glued to you after that.
Story. I'm a big dog lover myself and have done quite a bit of rescuing in my day. I wish
Wonderful.
you'd been around. I actually had one that Jack that I'd rescued from an Indian reservation, and I wasn't really looking for him, but I was going cross country heading home and was on a reservation and it was starving and I was horseback riding and it just I said, I do not need a dog at this point. I do not need another dog. Right now, my life is super crazy. That dog kept following. Every time I would let him out of the car to go,
Love it.
all right, I'm staying in this hotel or I'm going to dinner, he'd be waiting for me. That dog came and stayed with him, but he turned a little where he wasn't safe for kids, and I had little kids, so I turned him into a shelter. And unfortunately, it's supposed to be a no-kill shelter. Where were you, Ian? I needed to bring him to you. Anyway, I love that you did this, but the reason I bring this up is that I love for people to tell their journey because you get to connect the dots. And can you imagine that it took for you to find this chapter that you're so meant to do? It would have taken you getting fired. It would take your wife saying, yeah, I don't think so. We're staying. And then it would take going to a company that allowed dogs to be there during the day at the workday. That you say, wow, this is for me. Now I'm going to make a new choice. I just think it's fascinating what leads people to that thing that they were meant to do. So I really appreciate your story.
The software industry, in a weird way, prepared me for what I do with dogs. Training humans since the 90s. And when we started fostering, we became specialists at problem dogs, right? So dogs that had the same type of problems maybe that your dog had. And I just started applying the same rules that I thought about when I'm training humans. And dog packs behave very much like sales orgs sometimes. They've got one leader, there's got to be one alpha. 99 times it's a male, but I have had alpha female pack leaders here too. And sometimes they're 25 pounds and they're the alpha. And we've got a 120-pound mastiff outside today, and they will bow down to a little poodle if that's the alpha.
It
That
is amazing.
strong leadership is critical in the successful sales teams I've worked with. And then in human skills training, I mostly train negotiation skills, that kind of stuff. Repetition is the mother of skill, right? Practice, practice over and over again. That's how we qualify and certify people for top-level roles. And the same works with dogs. Repetition. People think that they can train a dog when it's a puppy and then stop training it. No, you're always training your dog. In fact, what I like to advise to adopters, a lot of times adopters will call us up after a few weeks and say, oh, he's chewed the sofa or something. And the truth is that dog owners are training their dogs every single day, whether they know it or not. A good example would be if you come home to a puppy and you're extremely excitable. Every time you see them and you go, oh, puppy, hello, puppy, fantastic. You're training that dog to be excited when you get home. And then we have people call us up and say, when he comes home, he loses his mind and he jumps around, he breaks things. And I'm saying, tell me about your day. How do you typically greet him? And if you don't want that to happen, then you need to train him to be calm when you come home. So when you come home, you walk in the door quietly, and until your dog is calm, you don't give them any attention or any affection. As soon as they're calm, you do. And that's a repetition thing again. I have a cousin actually out east in Connecticut. She had two Labradors, very much like the Marley and Me type of Labrador, right? They were just badly behaved, start to finish. They broke things, they ran through things. They were not in any way the sweet, well, they were sweet dogs, but out of control. And yeah, it only actually took her 2 weeks. Once I explained and understood what was happening and why those dogs were behaving the way they were. And we created a training program, if you want to call it that, but really it's just a lifestyle program. Within 2 or 3 weeks, she wrote me a mail saying, I can't believe this. They don't do that anymore. And they're good and they wait. And they will do it. Oftentimes, you can get results very quickly, Kelly, but you got to keep doing it, keep doing it. And that's like onboarding people in the software business. When they come fresh off that course, sure, right there and then, they're probably pretty well trained. But if they don't then go into the field and start practicing that every day as frequently as possible, they're going to lose those skills. So fortunately for people like me, I get paid to re-up those skills.
See the translation easily. You're absolutely right. I completely get it. With dogs, I certainly get it. I've got a 125-pound shepherd, and you, it's harder to start later than it is to start from the beginning on how you're going to greet each other and how when what the experience is going to be coming home. But let's translate something else you said. The lead dog, there's in any group, whether they're dogs or people, there's always the top dog. There's always the one that everybody else is looking to. Not everybody's a leader, and leaders are leaders, but they do better when they have followers. So, how do you translate that training skill to identifying the leader of the pack in a company and creating that relationship where everyone else now is much easier to convert to the new plan, the new training plan?
Yeah, that's a great question. Back up a little bit. One of the big similarities between training dogs and training salespeople is that salespeople are reward incentivized, right? Commissions, spiffs, bonuses. Most dog training is treat, is either a treat or sometimes it's a toy or a conker, or a ball. But it's again, it's reward generated, right? And most people think that dogs are only interested in food as things, but most police dogs, army dogs, drug sniffing dogs, they aren't trained with food. They're trained with a ball or a toy, a favorite toy. And what that tells you is it's actually the recognition that they crave and not just the food or the treat. And I believe that's very true of salespeople. I've defended salespeople my whole career because the stereotype idea out there is that they're only interested in money, and as soon as they get the sale, they'll disappear off over the horizon with their bags of money, and that they're coin operated, and all these various different slurs you'll hear about salespeople, right? In my experience, that's not true. Recognition is still probably their top motivation. Standing up at that company SKO or that QBR, presenting their work, presenting their achievements. It's not about the Rolex or the little plaque that I literally know and have worked with salespeople who would get these plaques, these little glass awards every quarter, and they would go straight in the trash. They would literally, I don't care about that. I don't want this little piece of glass. I want to stand up at the SKO in front of 5,000 people and talk about how we closed that deal or something like that. So your question is a good one. I don't know that I'm answering it very well, but when it comes to translating the leadership piece, my Harry, who's on the cover of my book, he's about 30 pounds and he's a very quiet dog. He does not bark a lot. He doesn't make a lot of noise. He's old. He's 12 years old. So he quietly leads. He is the quiet alpha, and every other dog that comes in here learns very quickly that Harry is the boss. But he's not a barker, and he's a very fair alpha, right? So that's another great thing I see with great sales leaders, is they practice fairness across their teams. And this is probably why I got fired, because I was so unhappy with the unfairness of the way minorities were being rewarded here in America versus people who look like me. So I think that the best sales leaders are not really mouthy, loud, tell everyone what to do types all the time. They lead by example, right? They lead by fairness. They prove to everyone on the team that they're going to be fair across. And sometimes these coach people who had 300 people in their organizations. And some of the coaching I would do with them would be about, when was the last time you visited this team? Oh, shoot, I haven't been to Florida in 2 years. If you've been visiting these other teams and not that one, they're doing fine. Yeah, sure, they're doing fine, but maybe they're doing fine because of your visits. Also, I found here in America a lot that some of our international, and most of the companies I've worked for have had offices all over the world, riverbed. I went from Bali to Berlin to all over the world with them. And yeah, out of sight, out of mind sometimes, Kelly, right? It's like, I remember going to down to Australia to run the course, and I think I was there for about a week in Sydney. And as I was leaving, one of them said to me, "Ian, when do you think we'll get some more training?" And I was like, "Just request it like you usually do, and I'll come down." They go, "We requested it 2 years ago."
That gets down to a lot of what you're sharing is so powerful because it really gets down to human connection. When you're talking about that, just that alone, Yeah, we asked 2 years ago, which translates to nobody's listening. Nobody's hearing me. It's the same thing with being equitable. There was something that you said that I thought was so great. I'm one of those people. I was in the gaming industry. It was a very competitive industry, especially if, and there weren't a lot of women in gaming.
Yeah, but
I'm not talking about tech gaming. I'm talking about like real casino gaming, right? And I would get all these awards, and I did exactly that. I tossed them. They just weren't important to me. What was more important is if someone acknowledges the movement that you've created, that you've initiated and made a change. It was really about being seen. It's not
yeah.
any different in a relationship. Really, all of this is about relationship in any marriage, in any successful partnership, business partnership. People are looking to be seen and understood. They want to be acknowledged for what they bring to the table. And if you aren't doing that in a relationship, you will lose your partner. They'll look somewhere else for that acknowledgement to be seen. Same thing in a company. If everything I'm putting in every week for your company isn't being seen, pretty soon I'm going to look somewhere else because trophies only go so far.
Not true. Funny you
Right.
mentioned the marriage piece. I actually used sales skills to marry Amy, my wife, and I'll explain very quickly why. There's a pretty standard sales skill that most people would be introduced to, which is about time, agenda, and outcome. It's, can we spend 30 minutes? We're going to take a look at this demo, and at the end of it, you can decide whether you'd like to explore it better. Something like that. And I learned that on a course, I don't know, 30 years ago. So I'm a divorcee. I was married for 5 years in my 20s. No children, no acrimony, all fine, but didn't work out. And I realized why. And the reason was that I wanted to move to America. And my first wife, Martha, was Irish and didn't want to move to America. So getting married and proposing is very easy. You say, will you marry me? And that person says yes, or hopefully says yes. But you didn't put an outcome into it. So when I proposed to Amy, I said to her, will you marry me for 50 years? And fortunately, she said yes, but I was 40 at the time. And she said, yes, of course, but why are you saying the 50 years thing? And I said, my dad made it to 87, my mom made it to 84. I'm shooting for 90. So the outcome for me was, will you grow old with me? You know, that's actually what I was asking her. And I feel
Oh, I
like
love this.
in my first marriage, like most people, will you marry me? Yeah, sure, great. Weddings are fun. Everybody loves going to a wedding. You have a party and, you know, you got. Go on a honeymoon and all that good stuff, but there is no perceived outcome after that. It's just that question. And what is it? I don't know what the rates are here, but it's 40% people divorce or something like that, 50%. So, yeah, it was just the way I phrased it. And I laughed about it. And of course, she said yes, but every year on our anniversary, I go, only 37 left to go, dear. Only 36 left. Only 35 more years.
That clarity. And the truth is, that's alignment. That's truthfully, that is a goal, but there's alignment in the goal. You both decide. If you told it's the same thing as I want children and you don't, pretty much this isn't gonna work out. I remember I too am the second time around. Thank you for the first marriage, appreciate it. Thank you for that son, wouldn't change it. Love him, love the ex-husband dearly. He loves me. It wasn't acrimonious at all.
Wonderful, wonderful.
It only was that was a shorter chapter than I initially had planned. Let's put it that way. But the next time around, my husband, something separate that he did, something different, he kept wanting to get married. And I kept thinking, yeah, I need to do that again. And you know what the deal point was? The one that sold it is he said, stop it. I want to build a life with you. I want to. And in my mind, I said, 40 years. I had no idea. I didn't realize I might live so long. But I think I'm changing it to 50. I'm going to consult with him about it at dinner tonight. But it was the long term. Like, no, we're building something together. And you've got to be in alignment. And that works in a company as well. You can't have people not united in the
The
goal, but
goal,
they have to be
right?
acknowledged, and they have to be in agreement, and then acknowledge that they're participating in the accomplishment we're all trying to make together. That's easy to do.
I love that.
I love this. Now, what surprised you most about now you're running the dog rescue, which is a lot more sane, but how was it compared to leading a sales team? Did you know this is exactly the thing that I love the most? What
Yeah, so That's a great, another great question. And just for the record, I still work in the tech industry. I consult, and that's how I actually fund the rescue. So we're 95% self-funded, I think. We
Oh,
get some
great.
donations and we get some Amazon gifts sometimes, but the book, all the proceeds of the book go to directly to the nonprofit, not to me, et cetera, et cetera. But I'd been in three different Silicon Valley startups where their goal did not appear to be to build a sustainable long-term business. Their goal was to make as much money as they could quickly and then sell out. And you know the story, right? Over the last 10 years, half of the software brands that you used to know just don't exist anymore because they were bought by another company or they were merged by another company. And in particular, in the startup world, I worked in Palo Alto for a couple of years. There were people that I would meet and have a chat with, and a week later, hear that they sold their company for $50 million or something. And what typically would happen when I was at Oracle, they acquired over 100 companies in the time that the 8 years that I worked at Oracle. And most of those companies had their staff just savaged. They cut 90% of their staff and kept the very core critical people and integrated it into the big corporation. So there never seemed to be a really long-term goal for any of these guys other than get rich.
Like no continuity there. I
Right?
would let me ask you a question. This is perfect because this might be the explanation that I've been missing in so many tech companies and in tech projects that I've been involved in where I'm not the tech side, because it's not my specialty at all. But what I notice over the years is that tech thinks differently. In my day, the deal was whatever project you put together, whatever company that you built, you put your best work out, your very best product. That's it. That's the goal. But the tech now is we'll sell it before we build it. And when we build it, it's okay if we throw out crap the first three or four times. It's just beta. We'll see what reaction we get. Obviously, all those customers got burned, or they didn't get the results they were going for, and then we'll finally get to the product that we're going to be proud of. But it's a very different mindset. It took me a while to grasp just throwing something. I just can't do it. Just throw something out there that's mediocre and see if it floats. It's
Well,
contrary to my upbringing.
it's funny you mention it. One of the first courses I built for Oracle was for their version 7 software, and it was known as the Roach Motel of databases, right? Which meant that data went in, but nothing came out. And they pre-sold that for about a year before they'd even released it. When it did release, it was a dog, excuse the pun. And they got sued by many of their customers in the 90s. In fact, it almost cost Oracle their existence. But they scrambled their way out of it and released version 8, which was orders of magnitude better. But the other thing I noticed as well was that all the startups that I work for, as an enablement leader, I have to buy tools. And all the startups would go to the different vendors and I'd say, look, I need a learning management system or I need whatever, something like this, like Zoom or Gong or something like that. And I was always directed to purchase from companies that had the same venture capital backing that the company I was working was. And this just, in the beginning, I remember just thinking it was a bit of a coincidence. It's like, oh, everybody's their customer. But then as it grew on, I realized, actually, no, this is not really a fair marketplace here. I would select a product that I thought was superior, and I would be told by the CEO or the chief financial officer or something like that, no, you have to go with that particular company there. And then a little bit of
Goal
scraping,
is the
you scrape
goal
beneath
where
the surface, and yet they've got exactly the same venture capital company behind them. So a lot of times it was just, I think, rich investors moving their money around.
it's just the money. It's just the money grab then.
And you, to answer
Wow.
your question from earlier, the difference in rescue is exactly that. It's about the outcomes. It's like pulling a dog from a shelter, or a lot of them I just pull off the side of the road. We get phone calls all the time. Hey, Ian, there's a dog running around this highway here. But it's that we get to see the outcome. And I get a lot of Christmas cards from adopters, and I get text messages, and I get photographs and videos sent to me from all over America and Canada saying, Ian, 2 years ago, we adopted this dog from you, and he's just made our lives so wonderful, and we love him to death. And it's getting to know that outcome, that end goal. Or the dogs that were terrified and just shut down when they got here, and 2, 3 weeks later, they're running around the backyard playing with the puppies. Getting to see that is something I didn't often always see in the software industry. Do you know what I mean?
Satisfying.
You would see a big ticket number maybe, and yeah, I had my name on a few slides here and there, but other than that, you really didn't see the outcome of those customers being successful with your software or being profitable with whatever it was you had sold them. But in the rescue world, you really do.
So getting to see the fruition of your mission, getting to see it go from rescuing one to getting them ready to be adopted to finding a home where they are at their best is far more satisfying than sometimes being in business where everything's a trade out and you never get to see the end result of all your work and the goals and what you're trying to accomplish. I get that 100%. Is that why you wrote the book Rescuing Dogs and Salespeople, A Memoir from the Mutt?
Yeah, I am a mutt. I'm the original mutt, Kelly. I've got a German surname, Spandau. My mother was French. My father was Zimbabwean. I have four grandparents, none of whom I ever met, from four different continents, if you can believe that. One from Argentina, one from Africa, one from Europe, one from Asia. My mother, although French, was born in Penang, Malaysia. And my sister born in Nairobi, Kenya. So I am the original mutt in this story, do you know? And growing up in Ireland, we weren't Catholics and everyone on our entire street was Catholic, right? So we're always a little bit different in that respect. My neighbors were the Murphys and the O'Connors. So Spandau was, we were the weird people on the road. And the reason was that my father was an Air Force pilot and then a commercial pilot, and he got a job with Aer Lingus. And the only reason I have the accent I have is that he had two job offers. One was Pan Am. Glad we didn't go that route. But that would have been based out of Los Angeles, or Aer Lingus based out of Dublin. And at the time, the Vietnam War was on and they were drafting people here. And the obvious one for my father was to go to Pan Am. He was a 747 pilot. They had plenty of them. But he chose Aer Lingus because he didn't want his kids to be drafted. And that worked out incredibly well for him and I and my sister because Ireland was a wonderful place and a beautiful country to grow up in. Education there was terrific, honestly. I never even attended university myself, but I've run businesses and with just a regular high school education. I'm very grateful that they chose Ireland. We don't have any roots or anything in Ireland anymore. My sister lives in France. My parents have both passed away at this point. So I go back just for funerals and weddings at this point.
Magical place. I'm sorry, I've been to a lot of places in the world, but I find Ireland to be. I remember being there and thinking you should be the ambassadors to the world because they are so welcoming, they are so gracious, they really wrap their arms around you, and there's kindness there. I love Ireland. In fact, when I got there, I thought my whole trip, I was thinking, okay, I need to become a writer so I can justify renting a house of a cottage here for
Cottage
my
in the west of
business
Ireland,
meeting.
yeah.
Yeah, I just really felt this is home for me. And I'm fantastic. And you're such a great representation of what's so wonderful about Ireland. I think that's obvious. So now here's an interesting question I have for you. You draw this kind of direct parallel between underperforming salespeople and neglected dogs.
Yeah.
What opened you up specifically to that connection, and how do you resolve that?
Yeah, the second part of the question is the hard part. How do you resolve it? I coach a lot of sales leaders. And what I'll usually do is I'll start with their calendar and I'll say, can I just take a look at your calendar? Tell me what your typical week looks like. Nine times out of 10, they'll have one-to-ones with each of their employees, right? And I would ask them this first question. If you're have a one-to-one and your boss calls you up, for instance, and says, hey, listen, can you meet me at 3 o'clock? What do you typically do? And what they'll always do is they'll say, oh, I'll just call my guy and say, listen, can we move to tomorrow or can we postpone till later on? And that is exactly why those people feel undervalued, because they're not the top priority of their sales manager. The top priority of the sales manager is usually reaching a number or pleasing their boss or hitting their targets, right? So I'll give you a scenario, right? You've got six people on your sales team. Three of them are performing great. Two of them, one of them's a rock star. Three of them are performing fine, but two of them are, struggling. And one in particular is struggling the most. Now, I'm a sales manager. On Monday morning, I get two different emails. One of them is from my top performer who says, hey, boss, can you jump on a call with me with this customer? I think I'm going to close another deal. And the other one is from the rep who has no pipeline and no business to talk about, but has their one-on-one scheduled for that time. Sadly, nine times out of 10, that sales manager naturally is going to go, yeah, I want to hang out with the successful guy. I want to go and get on that call. And that's the favorite call I have all week. Salespeople love closing deals. Sales managers love closing deals. What they don't like doing is talking to a sales rep who doesn't have any deals to talk about and is struggling. So sadly, that has been the case with dogs as well, right? The friendly, lovely dog that jumps up and lap on your lap all the time and kisses you and wants to play ball, that's the dog you're probably going to give more attention to, right? And if you've got one that's sitting over in the corner being grumpy and maybe quite quiet and all that, it's easy. I understand. I don't judge, but it is easy to neglect those dogs. And then that becomes a sort of a cyclical thing in their head. I have worked with so many salespeople who killed it in their last role, just crushed it. They were great. They did really well. And then they moved job to a different company. And 9 months later, they were laid off or they were fired for underperformance. So the question then you ask is, you didn't lose all your sales skills in that time. You didn't forget everything you'd learned. If you were super successful at X company, why wouldn't you be super successful at Y company too, or Z company? The leadership. Back to the leadership. And of course, back to the training, the onboarding and the training. And it's stunning to me. I've literally had people that I would have bet my house would be successful in a certain role. Somebody call me up and say, Ian, can you make a reference for this particular student that you used to have? I say, yeah, fantastic student, top performer. Couldn't recommend him high enough. And 6 months later, he's fired. And you scratch your head and you go, it can't all be on him. It can't all be on that particular sales rep. There must be other slices of this pie that contributed to his failure. And leadership is often that
Leadership
biggest
is
focus.
it. It's the care and nurturing of salespeople. And again, salespeople, without sales, companies die. It's like with marketing, same thing. People say, oh, just cut the marketing budget. I've been in that for a long time. I understand that. But no, if you when you stop marketing, you die. More than that, if you lose your salespeople, you don't exist. You'll disappear. So
That's fine.
I know you are so much about this. Let me get to a question that I think is really important for our audience because this show is called the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight for a reason. And obviously, I am a big proponent of public speaking, the power of public speaking in any situation. If you want to increase your value, your tribe, your sales, just about anything that's important to you, your message needs to get out there, and public speaking is critical. You are a beautiful public speaker, but would you agree that public speaking is an essential element if you're in sales?
Yeah, I really do. I belong to Toastmasters. I'm sure you're familiar. For many years, I was in Toastmasters, and the top performers, the top leaders, and all that, they didn't think they knew it all. They came to Toastmasters and they practiced and they learned. And they cut the ums and ahs out of their dialogue, and they learned how to construct a sentence properly and finish it properly, and all that good stuff. I'm a really strong believer in Simon Sinek. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He
Love him.
so he'll tell you that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And this is really one of the principal reasons that I published my book, because there are probably 10,000 public speakers like me who worked in the software industry, Silicon Valley, what have you. Sure, they're all pretty good, I'm sure, but what's the why? If the why is just so that you can have a mountain retreat and a new Ferrari or something, yeah, I don't think that's a very good why. I walked away from a very large salary in my last role because the why was more important to me than the wealth, right? I call myself the richest person in California because I get spiritual income every single day. And when I worked in full time in technology, I really didn't get very much spiritual income at all. I got lots of financial income, sure. The reward was occasional. Sure, there were some. I got invited to a lot of weddings in my time and things like that. I'm a godfather 4 times over, I think. Really, it's just about making revenue for the firm. But the spiritual income, like I say, is incredibly important to me. I'm kicking off what I hope this year will be my most successful public speaking year. And it's really all about the dogs. And you know what? Many of my customers have dogs, and many of them love dogs too. So if they can,
People do, Ian.
right, if they can get a
Respect.
twofer, they get some good sales training, but they also get to hang out with a beautiful, I bring Chief, one of my boys, he's lying here beside me. I bring him with me when I can, and he'll sit quietly and do tricks for them in the classroom, and they love that. And where I work with dog-friendly offices, it's been amusing because I'm typically in a classroom in some kind of training room, boardroom. Whereas most people, their dogs are lying by their desk or whatever. So when I do that, I will always go in and I will say, by the way, if anyone has dogs here and they want them to be trained too, just throw them into the classroom. So I have had classrooms where there was four or five dogs lying behind me from where I was delivering my PowerPoint or whatever it was. And that is just the best day's work you can imagine. Yeah, it's the best day's work you can imagine.
That makes you very memorable. No one is ever going to forget being in a training class with you. I think that's phenomenal. I always ask people too, are they dog lovers? Are they
Yeah.
animal lovers? I am. And if they're not, it's fine. But it's funny. That kind of makes a difference. I see a different side to them when I find out that they love
Right.
animals.
Well, let me give you a little tip on that one. And I've done this a lot. Most people, particularly if you have a German Shepherd like I do, if they're dog owners and you look carefully enough, you will usually see dog hair on them. Right. So I have this little trick I do. And when I notice it with somebody and I might have just met them, I'll say, "What's your dog's name?" And they always go, "How did you know I had a dog?" And I was like, "Your sock has a lot of dog hair on it. You clearly have a dog." And most times I'll be dead right. And they'll be like, "Actually, we've got three of them, or we've got two of them, or whatever else." But it's a really
Way funny.
instant way to bond with people is fellow dog owners. I don't know. I think dog owners are just good people in general. I love cats as well, by the way. And we have a partner rescue here in Grass Valley that is a cat rescue, and we help each other out in any way we can, of course. So I love all animals, but dogs are just that cut above. They're just special.
Man, that's a real that's just really tells me a lot about you. And I've been identified. Now I have many different types of dog. I've had many, but I am a shepherd girl at heart. I have a long-haired German shepherd now, a King Shepherd right now. And yes, the hair, the German Shedder is alive and well because yes, it's everywhere. You cannot get rid of it 100%, and it's worth every bit of it. Worth
They
every
haven't
bit of it.
made a Roomba yet that can handle my pack.
True. That's hilarious. I just love hearing this. I think this is an incredible conversation that is so down to earth and so about what's really important. I just can't thank you enough. Now, on the things that are coming up next for you, I would love to know what else is going on that is your next favorite thing that you're working on.
I hesitate to use the word work. And it's funny that people do say that, a lot of adopters and all that, they say, "Oh, the work you do is so important." And I flinch when I hear the word work. Because if I won the lottery, do you know what I mean, Kelly? I would just go to the nearest pound, I would empty it out of dogs, I'd bring them all home. I can't think of anything I would rather do than spend time with dogs. You say it's work. No, it's not work. It's the most pleasure. It's the most enjoyable thing you could possibly imagine for a start. What I do consider work, though, is the corporate consulting and coaching and training that I do. And the reason I consider it work, my next one is going to be in Chicago next month. It means I have to go away from my dogs for a day or two. That's the only thing that I don't, and that's the downside to it. I was a million mile guy on United, so I have good status and all that. And I traveled relentlessly from the age of 20 to the age of 50 odd, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And if I never see another plane or another airport, it'll still be 10 years too soon for me, Kelly. Do you know what I mean? I am so happy now just being here in California with my lovely dogs and my beautiful wife. But work for me is typically is traveling to train. I do some quite a lot on Zoom, of course, and remote stuff, but doesn't really replace that classroom experience. So I go on the road as frequently as I can. What I'm trying to move towards now, rather than the full 1 or 2 days training that I usually provide, is to do keynote speeches or kickoffs, that kind of stuff, motivational speeches, things like that. And like I say, in any group of people, probably half of them are either dog owners or somebody in their family is a dog owner, or there's mom and dad have a dog at home or something like that. So I always try and give some good, healthy, positive tips and show a couple of videos and all that about dog training and about how you can use some of these sales skills that you have to get a better relationship with your dog. And again, people think, "Hey, I got sales training and I got some dog tips for free." So that's where
Got dog
I
tips for
really use.
free.
Yeah.
Everybody loves those. They
Right.
just do. I think it's fabulous. Ian, I just want to thank you so much for being here. And I think Will Rogers once said, the very famous Will Rogers, and my father repeated this to me, is find what you love to do and you never work a day in your life.
That's one.
And I think you have found that.
Nailed it.
And it's funny, my husband and I talk about the lottery and we figure we've already won it. Not the big cash payoff that everybody imagines, but the
Yeah.
fact that you love being where you are. For
Yeah.
us, that's home. And you
Yeah.
love the most important things that are around you. For you and
Yeah.
I, it's animals, my husband too. And that we get to do work that we love and make a contribution and not have to travel all the time, which I love too. That you've got it. You've created
Yeah.
a magical life.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And we are far from rich, believe me. But it just, when I was 29, I think I mentioned to you I was worth a couple of million pound, euro back then. And that was a long time ago when a couple of million was a lot of money. Lost every cent of it. And yet I feel so much richer today than I ever did back then. I drive a 10-year-old SUV and it's just fine, runs great. And it's got so many dog hair in it all the time that I don't even want a new car because it'll just get trashed with dog hair and what have you.
Delicious. And that's really such a great message to leave the audience with is that start defining for yourself what does wealth look like to you? And if
Yeah.
the first, whatever the first couple words that come out of your mouth, you might find out that this seeking all the money and position and blah, 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 all the things that everybody thinks you should want. Mine was freedom and choice to be where I want to be every day. And to make a difference while I do it, hey, that's a great life. So I cannot thank you enough for being here today. It's not every day we get to chat with someone who not only has led global sales teams and at the same time cleans up muddy rescue dogs in the same breath. I clearly see you like one better than the other. So thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you, Kelly.
It's been fabulous. I love your journey. I love your perspective. And it was a total gift of a conversation. I hope that you will come back again. I'd love to have you back on the show.
I would love to come back, Kelly. I've enjoyed this a lot.
And everybody, there are so many takeaways from this that I think are so delicious. But leadership, it doesn't have to come with a title. He might just be the lead dog and not even know it. But
Yeah.
it really comes from, and your life is an example of this, is showing up and standing up and sticking around when things get messy, sometimes literally. And whether you're managing a team or you're rehabilitating a traumatized dog, same rule applies. Patience and empathy and consistency. That always
Yeah.
seems to be the word that sticks out. It really changes
Yeah.
everything. So, for everyone out there that wants more of Ian's bold wisdom and his honesty that I find deliciously refreshing, head over to his site at spendowhouse.com. Check out his book, Rescuing Dogs and Salespeople, A Memoir from the Mutt. It's on Amazon, of course. It's not just a read, it's really a wake-up call, and it's wrapped up in heart and humor. That's what Ian's all about. Clearly, you can see. And also, I want to point out, Ian doesn't just use public speaking to share ideas. He really uses it to shake up people and connect the dots between purpose and profession and to call out garbage with style. He's that kind of voice that changes the conversation. He doesn't just add to the noise, he makes a difference. So if you loved this chat, I'd love it if you hit or share the episode with someone who needs to hear it. We love your comments. Please don't be shy. Drop us a line. Let us know what you think. And on the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, we're not just about hyping public speaking. We're showing you how you can elevate your business, amplify your message, and help you actually move people. That's what Ian does. Imagine his life. Every day you can tell he wakes up happy, committed, motivated, and living a life he's chosen. So, with that said, glad you all joined us. Thank you, Ian, for coming on the show. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. I will see
Thank you, Kelly.
you
It's been a pleasure.
next time. It's been a fabulous pleasure. Can't wait to see you again. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.